presenter was one of the students who was working at the Portsmouth, Ohio site that Bob mentioned earlier. It's Mary Catherine Fletcher, who's currently an undergraduate student at North Carolina State University, majoring in biochemistry. She's originally from Shelby, North Carolina, and she's planning to attend public health graduate school focusing on occupational and rural health.
Hi, as he just said, I'm Mary Catherine, and I'm a student at North Carolina State University. My partner was Erica Wallace, a graduate student at Georgia Southern University, and she wasn't able to be here today. Our project took place in Portsmouth, Ohio, and examined how to best address the needs of workers who have become ill from chemical and radiological exposures at their tenure at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, a uranium enrichment facility. Post-World War II, production of nuclear weapons was considered imperative to national security and defense in the U.S. Pressures to increase production, along with a lack of knowledge regarding health effects, resulted in safety being placed on a back burner for many of these workers. During the Cold War, thousands of men and women came together to safeguard our nation by working at nuclear weapon production facilities. They endured decades of exposures to radiation, chemicals, and other toxic substances with little to no protection. Many of these men and women have already made the ultimate sacrifice, and there are thousands of workers who are currently receiving or will need medical care. Illnesses commonly seen among these workers include radiogenic cancers, heavy metal toxicities, asbestosis and mesothelioma, COPD, asthma, and the list continues to grow. The Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Act, EOIPA, was established to address medical care for the energy workers' illnesses caused by their occupational exposures. It is administered by the Department of Labor in cooperation with the Department of Energy and Health and Human Services. Basic qualifications are that a worker or former worker is diagnosed with a qualifying illness, the illness is related to their occupational exposures, and they worked in an area that was deemed to put them at risk for the occupational illness. EOIPA has two parts. It's a little bit of a hairy process. I'm just going to do a brief overview. It has two parts, B and E. Part B primarily covers radiogenic cancers and includes a special exposure cohort, which automatically designates people to receive compensation. If the condition is not a cancer classified under the special exposure cohort, NIOSH must use dose reconstruction to determine the probability that the occupational exposure caused the cancer. Part E covers chemical exposures, and it's the part we worked with the most. And this part can be more difficult to handle because there are limited worksite records on chemicals, and causation can be difficult to conclude. Part E requires that a physician review the claimant's medical history and exposures and deem that the medical condition is at least as likely as not caused by, aggravated by, or contributed to by the worker's occupational exposure. When workers are actually brave enough to complete the claims process, their cases are reviewed by DOL's claims examiners. Qualifications to become a claims examiner, however, do not necessarily require that these individuals have a medical, health, or scientific background needed to effectively evaluate these claims. My partner and I believe this might have contributed to inconsistent findings and a lot of men and women being denied compensation. Another issue we believe affects the number of claims accepted is that claimants often submit incomplete claims due to a lack of knowledge. While we can't improve the overall process now, our goal was to simplify the components for claimants in order for them to submit complete claims to go through the process. The Worker Health Protection Program, WHIP, and WHIP coordinators at the local Portsmouth United Steelworkers Hall identified the need for documents that comprehensively and succinctly walked claimants through applying to EOIPA. The WHIP coordinators also felt that there was a lack of cooperation and knowledge from area physicians about occupational illnesses. This is important because claimants are required to have a physician's statement as part of their claim. In order to simplify the process for physicians and educate them on occupational illnesses, we needed a second document to address these issues. A parallel objective was interacting with current and former workers in order to identify the key characteristics of our target population. We needed to understand who we were writing these manuscripts for and how we could best serve them. To give you a little background about the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, it was located in rural Ohio and enriched uranium to weapon grade all throughout the Cold War. After the war officially ended, it produced lower grade uranium for energy uses. At its peak, the plant was more like a town rather than a plant, having its own fire department, police force, hospital, water sanitation, cafeteria, really just a little town. Currently, the plant is being converted into a centrifuge plant. We were fortunate enough to go into our project with a relatively clear idea of what was needed. We developed a rough draft based on the needs identified by the WIP coordinators, and we were able to interview current and former workers before finalizing the draft. We were able to gauge their literacy, find out how much they already knew about EOCPA, and connect real people to the words we were writing. All the documents we created were created to be adaptable to other sites covered by EOCPA. My partner and I made two pamphlets for claimants to help them through the process, 42 fact sheets for claimants and their doctors, and educational handouts for physicians. Safety was a very interesting factor. Some workers said they felt very safe working at the plants because they wore dosimetry badges and had radiation checkpoints. Others said they were always concerned about their safety because they had no clue what they were working with. Money was also a major factor for these people. They could make almost twice as much money working at the plants than they could for their other work opportunities in the area. The most challenging aspect of this project was understanding EOCPA and compiling the necessary information in a succinct fashion. I feel my partner and I both learned so much about a time in American history that neither of us were very familiar with. The workers we interviewed really gave us an idea of what the town was like. One of the most important aspects of this experience was building a relationship between OHIP and the Worker Health Protection Program. There's so much work that still needs to be done, and we hope future interns can expand our project to cover more areas. The Worker Health Protection Program is doing great things for current and former workers. We believe that WIP should assist the individual union halls with better utilizing technology, especially to analyze trends within the compensation program. We have encouraged the local United Steelworkers Hall and other sites to actively pursue relationships with area physicians and provide educational handouts for them to better understand the occupational illnesses their patients are facing. One major concern drawn from interactions with former workers is that workers might be disproportionately affected by heart disease, a illness that's not covered under EOCPA. On its website, NIOSH acknowledges that associations between some occupational exposures and heart disease have been demonstrated, and we agree that further research on this topic needs to be done. Another issue with the process is that synergistic effects of radiation and chemical exposures are not used in calculating probability of causation. This is a topic that definitely needs further research. Looking back on this summer, the experience has taught me the importance of protecting workers because their workplace hazards not only affect them, but their families and communities. Even though EOCPA provides a way for workers to pay for their medical care, they should have never been exposed to the amounts of radiation and chemicals that they were. The experience has really made me passionate about helping these former workers and preventing occupational exposures in the future. I plan to attend graduate school and pursue a career in occupational and rural health. I was fortunate to have caring and knowledgeable supervisors. Thank you, Matt London and Tom McQuiston. And I've definitely gained a great appreciation for the sacrifices of the Cold War patriots. They kept our country safe when nobody else could. So I'm grateful for the workers who told us their stories. Thanks lastly to the organizations who are diligently promoting safety and health for nuclear workers, including the United Steelworkers Department of Health, Safety, and the Environment, the Tony Mazzocchi Center, and Queens College Center for Biology and Natural Systems. Thank you for your time. I look forward to your questions.
Hello everyone, I'm Roxana, and it's a pleasure to speak to you today. My partner and I worked on the San Diego taxi driver's health and safety issues this past summer. And I have no relationships to disclose. So our pre-study goals and objectives were to become familiar with the taxi driver industry through research, design a well-rounded survey that targets the health and safety of San Diego taxi drivers, survey at least 50 taxi drivers, identify work-related illnesses, injuries, and safety hazards that drivers are exposed to in their workplace, and also identify the main causes of the occupational health issues. Also, we want to create a give-back product that will be useful and sustainable for the taxi driver community. So our key partners and players during our research were the United Taxi Workers and Employee Rights Center. They helped us establish interviews within the taxi driver community and also provided us with feedback in regards to our survey and final report. They were a huge support team, and they really helped us in our area of research. So some issues serving in San Diego were the access to drivers. We had to go to many different locations to find drivers in groups who had time to be surveyed. If they were not in groups, it was harder to get a completed survey because of the pickup requests and the customer calls. San Diego, compared to other large and urban cities, does not have as many taxi drivers readily available as well. Another issue was most of the drivers we surveyed were Somali and did speak some English. However, many of the drivers did not speak English fluently, so comprehensively we did face some communication obstacles. So how we approach these issues, we primarily surveyed in areas with large amounts of taxis. Typically, we would start the back of the line and work our way up. Taxi drivers line up in the order of who arrives first, so those at the front of the line get called up the quickest for customers. Also, when there were language barriers, we tried our hardest to help them understand the question by rewording it or re-explaining it. If they still don't understand, then we asked one of the other drivers who spoke English more fluently to help translate in Somali. So locations where we surveyed, primarily in downtown San Diego, Horton Plaza, Westin Hotel, the Marriott Marquis, San Diego Convention Center, the Community Police Center for the UTW monthly meeting, Old Town Transit Center, Fashion Valley Mall, Mission Bay, Pacific Beach, and the San Diego Airport holding lot. and this is at the UTW meeting, and those are our business cards. You would pass those out after each interview, just in case drivers want to follow up or had any additional questions, the UTW would answer them for them. And those were our badges. So some study limitations included the access to drivers. The number of drivers that we actually served in San Diego was small, just given the short time frame of the study. We were also serving during Comic-Con week, which affects the number of taxis that were available because they were busier than usual given the large event. And for those of you that do not know what Comic-Con is, it's this huge convention that goes on for about 4 days in San Diego, and during that time we get a large influx of tourists. So, and then also our survey time length. We wanted to ask all the questions that we found important for a first-time tax driver survey in San Diego. However, we had to cut out a large sum of questions to stay in the 10-minute time frame, which still led us to having 10 incomplete surveys out of 50. And I also left out the airport holding lot. That was an issue because this is one of the best locations to actually survey tax drivers. Unfortunately, we faced some political obstacles that led us not being able to survey at this location. To give you some occupation background on this group, taxi drivers typically work 12-hour shifts 7 days a week, have no sick or vacation leave, and this also depends on whether they're a lease driver or an owner. Owners tend to have more flexibility in their work schedules, but 86% of the drivers that we surveyed were lease drivers, 100% of the drivers that we surveyed were male, and the average use of driving for this particular cohort was 6.64 years. So some of our findings included, when we asked drivers if they have body aches and pains as a result of their job, 63% said yes. When we asked them to indicate which part of their body caused the most discomfort, 68% indicated their lower back. The biggest issues that tax drivers had in common were 62% said high lease rates, 43% indicated ticketing from police officers, and 19% indicated the long work hours. When we asked drivers if they had health insurance, 56% said no. When we asked drivers if they skip a meal, 70% of drivers indicated that they skip at least one meal a day. 38% of drivers reported gaining weight since they had started driving taxis. And when asked how often they use the restroom, 44% of drivers indicated that they only use the restroom 1 to 2 times per 12-hour shift. Additionally, we found that 32% of drivers have been robbed, and 93% reported that the incident took place at their night shift, ranging from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., and 66% of drivers have been verbally assaulted. 67% of the drivers also indicated that, in their opinion, they were assaulted because the customer was either highly intoxicated or under the influence of some type of substance. So for give back products, through our survey results, we found that 62% of drivers do not have first aid kits in their vehicles. So we decided to purchase 100 Johnson & Johnson first aid kits and design makeshift first aid kits to give back to the drivers. We made a brochure including the contents found in the makeshift kits and a step-by-step guide that allows drivers to make their own inexpensive kits at home. We thought that this would be a very useful product that promotes health and safety, especially for drivers in case of emergencies when they are on the road. Additionally, we also designed a health and safety flyer that promotes healthy behaviors during and after work hours. The flyer also provides drivers with community health resources for healthcare and financial assistance. We presented our final report and distributed our give back products on August 13th at the United Taxi Workers meeting, and the drivers are very thankful of the products that we have provided to them. So some recommendations for organizations: continue to educate and empower San Diego taxi drivers, for the UTW to follow up on the give back products to see if they're useful and sustainable within the taxi driver community, make membership free for the UTW more affordable, and continue outreach for the taxi drivers. Also, to conduct new surveys with more specific questions targeting the health and safety issues using the information from our survey results, and to also make the interview quite shorter this time, 5 to 6 minutes would be probably most feasible. Some recommendations for drivers: become a member of UTW if not so already, and be aware of your personal rights as a taxi driver through both the ERC and the UTW. Take care of your health and mental well-being using suggestions from the UTW website and the health and safety flyer, and encourage each other and work together. So in conclusion, we reached our goal. We had a total of 50 surveys, 40 complete and 10 incomplete. We learned a great deal in regards to the occupational health and safety of San Diego taxi drivers, which include the long work hours, the body aches and pains, especially the lower back, verbal abuse, assault and robbery, restroom access, and the poor dietary habits. We gained an appreciation and understanding of their occupation. We built relationships with taxi drivers and hope to have opened some doors of communication where the taxi drivers can evaluate their personal rights and voice any occupational health and safety concerns that they may experience during their careers. The Occupational Health Internship Program provided me with opportunities to become more engaged within my community and get hands-on experience with occupational health research and implementation. Learning about occupational health and safety this past summer also reconfirmed my passions and interests for this field because of my personal experiences with family members who have prominent careers yet still endure injuries from their own occupation or own their own private businesses and must adhere to OSHA regulations and standards. It was interesting for me to evaluate the different occupational hazards each field of work can acquire regardless of the occupational hierarchy. What makes a difference, however, is if the health issue is efficiently and effectively executed into a plan of action that can ultimately solve the problem. So this past summer was a great experience. And I'd like to thank all the people that made this possible. Thank you very much.
Corey Crane is a doctoral student in industrial and organizational psychology and occupational health psychology at Portland State University. Before attending graduate school, she worked as a research assistant at the Washington State University Sleep and Performance Research Center, where she managed field studies on fatigue-related neurobehavioral performance in commercial airline and motor coaches. And her current research interests include the work-family interface as it relates to sleep and health outcomes, in addition to the effect of sleep on sense fatigue on occupational safety and health.
Thank you. Good morning. So today I'm going to be presenting on two different projects. My partner Jacob Delbridge and I both worked on both of these projects. Unfortunately, Jacob couldn't be here today. And he primarily worked on this first project, developing effective labor management, health and safety committees among the metal manufacturing industries. And then I worked primarily on health and safety among commercial janitors. So today, I'm going to briefly introduce the first project on health and safety committees and then spend the majority of my time on the janitor project. And both of these projects were done under the supervision of Dr. Noah Satius, who's at the University of Washington. I have no relationships to disclose. So to start out, I'll talk about this project that we conducted on health and safety committees. And I should mention that both of these projects were already in progress when we came on as OHIP interns. So we just worked on a small piece of both of those research projects. So in Washington State, it's required that an organization has a health and safety committee if they have 11 or more employees on shift at one time. However, very little research has been conducted on what makes an effective health and safety committee, and therefore, there's very little information and resources available to organizations in determining how they can set up their own health and safety committees. So as a result, L&I provided the University of Washington team with funding to improve health and safety committee effectiveness. So this is actually a larger intervention study. But what we did is we worked with these 9 organizations, and those included scrapyards, foundries, and forges, and we conducted both baseline surveys and also hazard observations. And so we were primarily interested in exposures, PPE use, ergonomics, musculoskeletal disorders, safety climate, and perceptions of health and safety committee effectiveness. So Jake and I this summer, we were tasked first with conducting surveys with the workers. We also conducted on-site hazard observations, and so we did both the surveys and the hazard observations on smartphones and tablets. And then as a final project, Jake created a report of some of the baseline data that we found from just one of the sites, and then he actually presented it to their health and safety committee. So now that you know a little bit about that project, I'm going to move on and talk about our project on the health and safety among commercial janitors in the Seattle area. So in accordance with the current economy, many of the janitors have been laid off in the last few years. And so as a result, there's been increasing rates of workload and also increasing rates of accidents and injuries. And so to better understand this phenomenon that's going on, the University of Washington team, in addition to Casa Latina, which is a local day laborer center, and they do a lot of work with non-union janitors, and in addition to the SEIU Local 6, which represents many of these commercial janitors, they all got together to conduct this study. So this was a participatory-based study, and we worked with janitors in office, retail, and government buildings. And then we wanted to design a cross-sectional survey. And so we were primarily interested in these health outcomes of acute injury, musculoskeletal disorders, respiratory issues, dermal issues, and stress. And so Jake and I, what we were tasked with doing was first to just generally learn about the occupational risks faced by janitors in the area. And more specifically, we were to assist in the survey development phase of this project. So this project, since we've left, it's now in the second phase. And so there are actual interviewers out there who are using this survey, and they are doing this survey with approximately 275 janitors, union janitors, 75 non-union janitors, and then also 50 security guards that are kind of going to act as a control group to compare the janitors against. So we, in order to get this information to construct the survey, we first conducted key informant interviews with 5 janitors, and we did these in both Spanish and English, and we also held an advisory committee meeting with the community partners and some of the janitors. And so from this information that we gained from these initial conversations, we then used that in conjunction with past literature on janitorial work and developed this paper survey. And then we piloted the survey with janitors in both English and Spanish. And then lastly, towards the end of the summer, I prepared some materials for the training of the actual people that were going to be conducting the interviews with the janitors. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So what these initial conversations told us was that there were major safety concerns for these janitors. So first of all, many of them reported musculoskeletal disorders. As you can see in the lower left-hand corner, many of the janitors reported that these vacuum packs that they wore were extremely heavy, and they also got very hot. And then another thing that we heard from janitors is that a lot of them spent the majority of their time both collecting and transporting trash. And so you can see this black garbage bin down here. So what some janitors would tell us is that they would spend almost their entire shift both pushing a bin and pulling a bin. And these were full and extremely heavy, and so there were a lot of musculoskeletal disorders as a result of that. And then they also reported some dermal and respiratory issues from many of the chemicals that they were using, and also the dust. And then what also arose out of these initial conversations were that the janitors faced some major psychosocial stress factors. Specifically, they were working at an incredibly fast work pace, so they were essentially running for their entire 8-hour shift, trying to get everything done. Many also reported that it was very stressful working alone in isolation, so if an accident happened, not all of them were allowed to carry cell phones, so they were often at these organizations at night by themselves. There were also reports of abusive supervision. There were also reports of very high job insecurity, so many janitors wouldn't report their injuries for fear of being fired. One of the 5 janitors that we interviewed, she'd been working with a torn rotator cuff for about a year. However, she also reported that she thought her supervisor did place a high emphasis on safety. There were also reports of very high work-family conflict for these individuals, and that's a result of them working primarily nights, but also having to take care of children, and also having perhaps elders that they were trying to take care of as well. And then lastly, there were many communication issues because this is a highly diverse workforce, and so many times their supervisor didn't even speak their native language, and they were all of the safety information that they were given was in English, so many times they couldn't even comprehend this information that they were being given. So I made two different final products. The first product was a document to aid the advisory committee in the study implementation. And so this provided information from the key informant interviews in conjunction with past research on janitors. And I compiled that information so that the researchers could eventually use this text to write reports once the study was over and write publications once the study was over. And then I also created a one-page document to aid in the training of the actual interviewers. And this explained how those initial conversations with the janitors in the advisory committee meeting actually influenced what we put into the actual questionnaire. So we did face some challenges. It was very difficult convening our advisory committee meeting just because we had janitors, our research team, union representatives, and also CASA Latina staff. So it was hard getting everyone just in one place to talk about the study. Timing was also an issue for us. When Jake and I came on, the union was in the process of negotiating a new contract, and so we were very worried that the study would get delayed. But we also found some successes. So I think the major thing is that we learned from the janitors' experiences. What they told us really informed what we put into the questionnaire. I think had we not had those conversations with them, we may have been capturing issues that really weren't that salient to the janitors. And then we also we met all of our objectives of conducting the interviews, creating the survey, and piloting the survey, despite the initial challenges that we faced. So looking back on my summer, I'm just very grateful for this wonderful opportunity. I think one of the things that I enjoyed the most was just interacting with the janitors and hearing their stories. Everyone was so willing to share their experiences with us. Many even welcomed us into their homes so that we could meet with them in their off time because they had childcare issues. This was really important for me because I have a grandfather who is a janitor, and so I felt like my summer really connected me more to my family's story and the work that he's done and the working conditions that he faced. I also really enjoyed collaborating with the union and the Day Laborers Center. It was great to learn about how they serve the community and advocate for workers, and that was in those two organizations I hadn't known much about before. And then I also got an introduction to industrial hygiene, which is a discipline that I knew nothing about before coming onto this project, but I'm hoping to continue collaborating with Noah Satius and his team and using some of those principles in my own future work in more psychological research. And then lastly, I really feel that this experience has changed my own career trajectory. In my field, industrial organizational psychology, the majority of the research has been done with white-collar workers. And so as a result of this summer, I'm really interested in focusing my own future research with low-wage workers and their health and safety. So I'd like to thank all of these individuals for making this experience possible. And thank you.
I guess I'd just like to reiterate sort of how impressive these projects are, given a few of the constraints we work with when these are all 10-week projects, first of all, that happen over the course of the summer. So it's a very short period of time that all these activities have been conducted, and most of the students that come into the program actually are not coming in with explicit backgrounds in occupational health to begin with. So a lot of the work that we all do as academic support supervisors and site supervisors is to quickly bring the students up to speed on some of the basics about health and safety issues and then get them out doing these projects. So I think given those, I just want to acknowledge how much work these students really put in to produce these phenomenal results. So we have about 15 minutes. If people have questions to Susan Pretori or more generally.
I was wondering methodological rationale to security guards.
Sure. Yeah. No, I didn't touch on it. I just barely touched on it. So I think what we wanted to see, so we've seen with these janitors that over the last few years, a majority of them have been laid off. And so the janitors that are still there are doing the, like, one janitor is doing the work that three people used to do. And so what we wanted to see if this was also happening within other industries. And the security guards were actually also represented by that union. And so we were trying to pick a somewhat similar group but that wasn't a janitor, so that we could compare and see if they were facing the same sorts of pressures as the janitors were.
Right.
Yeah.
Other comments or questions?
You had a list of issues that the janitors themselves raised, like workdays and stuff like that, et cetera. Did you ask or did it surface up the issue of the latitude control over the way they are performing their job, et cetera? Because I know personally that janitors do complain about being told all the time how to do their job.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they have very little control over what they're doing. And I think it was interesting to hear the broad range of types of tasks that janitors did. And so there were some janitors that we interviewed who did only garbage for almost their entire time. And then we interviewed other janitors who had more flexibility in the types of tasks that they were doing throughout the day. But what we did hear is that there were some janitors who felt like I needed to spend more time doing this dusting, but they wouldn't let me do that. They wanted me to move on to something else. And that was clearly very stressful for them, that lack of decision latitude. So I think there was a lot of pressure from both the companies and from the supervisors in terms of what they wanted the janitors to be doing and when. Mm-hmm.
So not being able to carry a cell phone thing was really striking, given the fact that they're working alone. Has that come up in the past as a safety issue, and are there theoretically phones like in the buildings available? Like, how are they getting around that?
Yeah, so I think it varied by the company that. So the way it works is, so there's a higher level company like Microsoft that owns the building, and then they contract with a smaller cleaning company that the janitor actually works for. So the different cleaning companies would have different policies around cell phone use, but we actually heard reports of some companies who would change their policy. So there was one company that changed their policy so that their workers could use a cell phone, but they didn't even really inform their workers that they could be using a cell phone. And so some companies said, you can use the phones in the offices that you're cleaning, but you can only use these designated phones. And actually what happened was, prior to us coming onto this project, there was a janitor that had a heart attack on the job, and they didn't find her until after hours later when the shift was done. And basically, because she was essentially working in isolation, she didn't have a way to contact anyone, she's not working with anyone else, and so supervisors tend to check in with the janitors at the beginning of shift and at the end of shift, if that. Sometimes they don't always do that. So it's very difficult, and I think it seemed like it's not regulated, and it seemed like it depended on the company and also the supervisor. So. Thank you.
Okay.